لحظة.
Finally, the doctor said, there's nothing to be done. One of the guards said to them, my condolences. And they all started laughing. They put him in a black body bag and carried him out like trash.
We're joined right now by Sarit Mikaeli, International Advocacy Lead for the Israeli Human Rights Group at Salam. The group's new report is titled, Welcome to Hell, the Israeli Prison System as a Network of Torture Camps. Sarit, thanks so much for being with us. Just as we listen to these horrifying accounts, please lay out your findings.
I think on the very fundamental level, Amy, our findings look at the systemic, ongoing and state-sanctioned, government-sanctioned use of torture and abuse in the Israeli prison system vis-a-vis Palestinians. Palestinians who Israel considers to be views as security prisoners. Now, this is something that we have discussed in the past. I mean, torture and abuse of Palestinian detainees in detention and interrogations have occurred. They have been documented. But the level, the degree, the scope, the scale of this phenomenon since October 7th are simply unrelated to anything we've seen in the past. And when we look at the way these people are treated, you showed some of the testimonies. Some of the many more testimonies are actually available on our website, and we're sharing them online. You see that clearly this isn't the actions of any sort of rogue element of the Israeli prison system. It's a government sanctioned and also government supported, government mandated policy. And that's the essential conclusion that we have from all of the information that we've collected in recent months.
If you can talk about Firas, who was describing not only being beaten by the Israeli soldiers, but also the fact that this beating was being live streamed for the National Security Minister of Israel, Itamar Ben-Gvir, to watch?
So I just want to clarify, we know that the police, the prison guards were discussing this. Certainly we have not, we clarified in our communications that we don't know whether this was indeed like literally live streamed for Itamar Ben-Gvir, or whether it was more about the spirit of Itamar Ben-Gvir, because a lot of the things we see on the ground today in the Israeli prison system are directly related to the influence, to the spirit of Minister Ben-Gvir. I think it's certainly not the case that Minister Ben-Gvir is the only person responsible. Absolutely, the Prime Minister Netanyahu, who gave him all of this authority, is absolutely responsible and culpable for this reality. But the Israeli government and Ben-Gvir have shown again and again, since October 7th, but also before October 7th, that they are hell-bent, that their intention is to cause this deterioration, to increase the pressure on Palestinian prisoners. And this was this has been done, and we saw these kinds of developments even prior to October 7th. From the beginning of the tenure of Minister Ben-Gvir as Minister of National Security, he has been imposing his racist, his Kahanist agenda, both on the Israeli police, with great success, unfortunately, and also on the Israeli prison service. October 7th, the horror, the crimes committed against Israelis on October 7th served as a golden opportunity for Ben-Gvir to continue to cynically manipulate the Israeli trauma, the Israeli fear and anger, in order to push forward this agenda that he has been promoting even beforehand. So I think one of the clear things that we've seen on the ground in the system since October 7th was that much of this Israeli policy, at least the parts about starving prisoners, about cramping them all together in large numbers in sales, cancelling any possibility for them to have any sort of sustenance to buy additional food, for example. All of these policies have been declared. They've been stated by the Israeli government. They haven't hid this. Ben-Gvir himself has been on the media promoting these policies and showing, you know, having these like show visits to visit prisoners that he claims are Nukba, right? Our Palestinian, our Hamas fighters from Gaza. But what we have seen again and again, based on the testimonies that we've taken, is that the Israeli policy wasn't just applied to Palestinian Hamas suspects. We would argue, by the way, that this is absolutely categorically prohibited, regardless of the crimes people have been have committed. Torture and this type of treatment is absolutely prohibited. But Israel is claiming, and in some cases showing, right, performing in a way, and this is, I think, the incident that was described in this testimony seems very much an example of this. Not just the kind of actual violence and ill treatment and humiliation, but making it very, very public. And this is something that is simply chilling, and it's part of the really deep moral abyss that this report exposes, I think, within our society today.
The Israeli Supreme Court considered a petition yesterday to close a desert military prison where soldiers have been accused of abusing Palestinians. Most recently, this shocking video that aired on Israeli News 12, the Channel 12, showing Israeli soldiers sexually abusing a Palestinian prisoner. Talk about that video and what the Supreme Court is calling for, or if they've had a ruling yet.
Well, I think there's a few things to unpack in this situation. Again, regardless of the specifics of this individual case, B'Tselem hasn't documented it. We're not familiar enough with the details. I think this is a moment within Israeli society where the old way of doing things, which involved very often these sham investigations, right, pretending that we're holding soldiers accountable for violations of Palestinian rights and investigating suspected wrongdoing, this is rejected, is being rejected by a growing, maybe majority, certainly very large number of Israelis who are simply not interested in any kind of accountability because they do not believe that Palestinians deserve any rights. And this is an interesting and quite disturbing and very, very depressing situation to experience, because the power and the violence released by the recent, for example, charging of far-right activists into the Sde Teman military base and into the Beit Lid military base isn't just going to harm, you know, the specific investigative bodies that we are very critical of. This is an action that is very concerted and coordinated by the Israeli far right in order to scare off any type of law enforcement in Israeli society. And this is why I think it's so deeply connected to what we've seen yesterday in the High Court. There is a High Court petition against Sde Teman. Presented by the Israeli, by the Association for Civil Rights in Israel. And the state has, as is its custom, denied that there is any wrongdoing in Sde Teman. But there's also another kind of parallel development, which is that a far-right mob has actually verbally charged the High Court justices yesterday in the Israeli High Court and also tried to assault the lawyers acting on behalf of ACRI. And I think this is an excellent example of what has been happening to the gatekeepers in Israel. This is an example of why these gatekeepers, who were meant to protect against the type of abuses that we describe in this report, they've been so scared off, they've been so weakened and paralyzed after many, many years of these types of far-right and even quite centrist assaults, that the type of reality that we exposed in the report is allowed to go pretty much on as Minister Ben-Gvir pleases, with very little resistance from the High Court, the other courts, from the Attorney General. Now, certainly we have had, and we're still extremely critical of these institutions, of the Israeli court system, of the Israeli Attorney General, but we do expect them to stand up to this type of abuse, to this type of official torture. And I think one of the reasons why Ben-Gvir has been so successful in imposing his own agenda, his racist, Kahanist agenda, is this weakness, the cowering of the gatekeepers that have been weakened for so many years.
And can you talk about the protests that took place in the last days, trying to prevent the Israeli soldiers or police from being questioned about the sexual assault or the rape of a Palestinian prisoner?
Yeah, I mean, I think I should also maybe open this with the one point of light in the current reality, which is that since the publication of B'Tselem's report, and also since the publication and the exposure of the story about these really horrific suspicions in Sde Teman, there's been a very strong voice coming from Israelis who categorically oppose this. Not necessarily Israelis who are absolutely with B'Tselem on everything, mainstream Israelis who know, who understand that if you are a country that claims your democracy, of course we would take great issue with this, then you cannot simply abuse people because you suspect them or because you've accused them and even because you've convicted them of perpetrating the most horrific crimes. This is simply unacceptable, and people are saying this very openly in our society today. These might not be the majority of Israelis, but it's very heartening to hear these voices again and again, as I said, also in response to B'Tselem's report. But the story itself, the reason it got such prominence is because it really is it's something that one did not expect to see up until really the recent period. And I'm saying that even though, you know, as I said, B'Tselem's report also revealed additional cases of suspected sexual and gender-based abuse. The story of the suspicions of sexual abuse by soldiers in Sde Teman has generated a mass public outcry, but it's also generated a mass response by proponents of the far right, of the Kahanist movement in Israel, who simply do not want any kind of action by Israeli soldiers against Palestinians to be subject of any sort of accountability process. I mean, that's the whole point. From their perspective, they would like to have a completely open field in terms of what they could do to Palestinians, and this is both for soldiers and settlers, and anyone who tries to impose any, even the most rudimentary, the most basic level of accountability is attacked as an enemy of the state, as a traitor. And this brings us into quite an absurd situation where bodies that we are, as I said, are extremely critical of, for example, the state attorney's office and also the military advocate general's office, are now coming under fire, not for what we would argue is the correct reason, the fact that they have enabled Israel to allow the army and soldiers on the ground to use totally disproportionate force against Palestinians. They've enabled almost everything that Israel has been doing in Gaza in recent months: the mass killings, the starvation, the horrific things we have done in Gaza. This is not what the far right is criticizing these institutions for. The criticism is coming when, in the very, very rare cases where there is an occasional investigation, when the Israeli investigative bodies simply don't have any other choice. I'm assuming, I'm only speculating, right? But the fact that there is a CCTV footage of this alleged assault, and the fact that the story has become so prominent and the possibility of an internal whistleblower inside who reported this have left the authorities really with no option other than to conduct this investigation. Certainly many other cases and the broad policy is not investigated, but they are still attacked by the right for this tiny foray into accountability.
I want to go to yesterday's briefing at the U.S. State Department, where Matthew Miller is questioned about this issue. This is the reporter Rabia Iqlal-Turan.
Going back to Israel, Israeli media today released a video showing Israeli soldiers raping a Palestinian detainee at Sadeet Amman detention camp. The footage was very disturbing. I know you have commented on the reports about this detention center before, but we now have a new evidence, which is video. Have you seen that video, and do you have anything to say on that, and also the reports of, you know, rape in Israeli prisons?
So we have seen the video, and reports of sexual abuse of detainees are horrific. They ought to be investigated fully by the government of Israel, by the IDF. Prisoners need to be treated. Prisoners' human rights need to be respected in all cases. And when there are alleged violations, the government of Israel needs to take steps to investigate those who are alleged to have committed abuses and, if appropriate, hold them accountable.
And actually, this is not the first rape incident we have been hearing about Israeli prisons. And Israeli human rights group Beth Salem on Monday released a report saying that Sadeet Amman is only tip of the iceberg and that, you know, Israeli detention centers turned into a network of torture camps for Palestinians. It reports cited testimonies from 55 Palestinian detainees. So I know the Israelis are investigating this, but would you support an independent investigation into those allegations?
So I would have to look at what the specific independent investigation people are calling for and pass judgment on the merits. But look, there ought to be zero tolerance for sexual abuse, rape of any detainee, period.
So that's the State Department spokesperson, Matthew Miller. Sadeet Makhayeli, if you could talk about the significance of what he is saying and what you're demanding at this point as the international advocacy lead for the Israeli human rights group at B'Tselem.
Yes, Amy. Well, I think the most important thing to clarify in terms of our response to this is that Israel is not going to hold an investigation into the conduct and into the policies in its detention centers for the pure reason, for the obvious reasons, that these are policies. They're not the actions of rogue elements, as I said. They're not the actions of individuals who are going against the grain. They're dictated by the management of the Israeli prison system and by the government. They're supported by these bodies. And therefore, the only options for investigations are individual cases that are either so egregious that it would be impossible for the authorities to ignore them because of international pressure, or in cases where there is some sort of documentation. And that is generally, I think, when you look at Israeli investigations, that is generally the way the Israeli authorities work. The small, isolated, token investigations cover up for broader policies. And in this specific case, I think, from our perspective, we have not requested Israeli investigations. B, we do not expect any Israeli investigations to fundamentally alter the situation. What we do expect is the international community to take action. And in the report, we've appealed to all nations and also to all relevant international institutions to look into the situation, to make it stop. Specifically, we've also appealed to the International Criminal Court, because these offenses that we list in our reports are war crimes. They also, we would argue, reach the magnitude of crimes against humanity. And this is the responsibility of the international community, including the United States government, to address. It's not just an intra-Israeli issue. Certainly the Israeli government, in its current standing, I mean, it's pretty blatantly obvious that if the Israeli government is not able to hold an investigation into such serious allegations of horrific abuse that without a mob of right-wing fanatics rushing, storming into two military bases, then it's blatant that Israel isn't going to be able, willing or able to address this broader policy of torture, you know, by order, essentially, in against Palestinians since October 7th.
Sarit Mikhaeli, I want to thank you for being with us from Tel Aviv, international advocacy lead for the international, for the Israeli human rights group B'Tselem. We'll link to your new report, Welcome to Hell. The Israeli prison system is a network of torture camps. When we come back, we get an update from Sudan. Back in 20 seconds.
Most people think great God will come from the sky, take away everything and make everybody feel high. But if you know what life is worth, you would look for yours on earth. And now you see the light, you stand up for your rights. Yeah. Get up, stand up, jump, jump. Stand up for your rights.
Stand up by the Wailers. This is Democracy Now!, democracynow.org. I'm Amy Goodman. We turn now to Sudan, where senior United Nations officials are calling on the global community to do more to get humanitarian aid into Sudan after a famine was declared in at least one part of the Darfur region following 15 months of war between the Sudanese military and the rapid support forces. Officials say more than a dozen more areas are at risk of famine as fighting impedes aid. Edem Wasornu of the Office for the Coordination of Humanitarian Affairs addressed the UN Security Council Tuesday.
When famine happens, it means we are too late. It means we did not do enough. It means we, the international community, have failed. This is an entirely man-made crisis and a shameful stain on our collective conscience.
For more, we're joined by the Sudanese activist Marine Al-Neil. She's now in Nairobi, Kenya, usually based in Khartoum in Sudan. Marine, thanks for joining us again. Explain how serious the situation is in Sudan right now, and what you think needs to happen to address this issue of famine and war.
Thank you, Amy. I think the situation, what we know about it, is that we do not know the gravity of the situation. When Adam was addressing the Security Council, one of the things she mentioned is that 26 million people are facing acute hunger, and compared that to three times the population of New York. And this has been a pattern of what is needed to humanize us as Sudanese, again, in international media. It's become synonymous with Sudan, words like war and famine. And it's been difficult to get the attention of the international community and the media when speaking about these catastrophes in Sudan. So we are not sure actually how many people are impacted by this famine. I will take us back to our history. It is not known in the 70 years of our, almost 70 years of our independence, how many famines happen. It's anywhere between 5 to 17 famines. And this is a continuous pattern in Sudan that catastrophes are always underreported, they're underdocumented. And bear in mind, when we say that 26 million people are facing this famine, we're not counting the refugees who are also starving in camps in neighboring countries. We are not counting the refugees who do not have refugee status, but are in different legal status in different places, or the internally displaced people who are also not reported as internally displaced because they went from an active conflict zone, and now they're staying with family in different areas. But everyone in Sudan is strained financially, and even just the means of sustenance that we're used to in areas outside of Khartoum, outside of the capital city. such as just having your own, growing your own crops, is also endangered by the war and endangered by the climate. We've entered the rainy season. Just last week, we've had torrential rains in the northern state. It's been reported that it's killed 17 people. But when you speak to the people who are still there in the northern state, you hear that maybe one person has heard of 17 deaths and attended 17 funerals. So we're seeing the pattern of things being underreported when it comes to the hunger that people are facing, when it comes to the displacement that people are facing, when it comes to the conflict-related sexual violence that people are facing. This is also something that's been reported from Khartoum, that it's becoming such a dire situation for women and girls there. And it's some of the reasons why we're not able to address the situation have to do with how it's being addressed. So, for example, the aid that is coming through UN agencies and their partners, these agencies are cooperating and listening to the Sudanese armed forces, although since the coup of 2021, this is not a legitimate government of Sudan. We've been suspended from the AU after the coup, and the situation has not been rectified. We're still, quote-unquote, governed by this military government. But somehow, for some reason, the UN still insists that if the SAF, the Sudanese Armed Forces, refuses for things to cross from their controlled areas to RSF-controlled areas, then we will not do that. And we've been seeing also that pattern of legitimizing the government happening on the pressures that are also happening on the civil society, where even the civil society that is working cross RSF and SAF-controlled areas, that the UN agencies and other agencies that are supporting with the aid just lift their hands from the situation so that they don't get into conflict or are considered biased to the RSF or the SAF. This has been detrimental to the Sudanese people, that we are still waiting for the SAF or the RSF to figure out the situation with each other and figure out the situation of how we're going to solve the issues that the people are facing, whether it's the hunger or the violence that is being faced. And I don't think that will ever happen. If we keep waiting for the RSF and SAF to figure out the situation, then this will be just a catastrophe, a continuing catastrophe for the Sudanese people.
And Maureen O'Neill, the talks that are scheduled between the two sides in Geneva that the U.S. officials would mediate, set for August 14th. Do you hold out hope for this Geneva meeting?
I personally do not hold any hope for this meeting. I think it's been a waste of our time and efforts as Sudanese people to keep focusing on RSF and SAF and their leaders. It is not news that the paramilitary forces, the rapid support forces that were created by the Sudanese government to commit the genocide of Darfur, that they're continuing to commit that in different regions of the country. That is not news. And it is not news that the SAF, the army that was established by the colonial forces, continues to be aligned to other forces. It's not even
Maureen,
clear
we
right
just
now.
Have 30 seconds. What do you think needs to happen?
I think what needs to happen is for the international community to pay attention to the Sudanese people and not the two warring parties. It is important to understand that what matters now is for people to eat, for people to live safely, and that is not going to happen through the work and effort of the same ones who are killing us and causing us to starve.
Maureen O'Neill, I want to thank you so much for being with us. Sudanese activists joining us from Nairobi, Kenya. That does it for our show. Democracy Now! Is produced by a remarkable team of people. I thank everyone. I'm Amy Goodman. Thanks for joining us.
J'ai choisi Siwi parce que d'abord c'est proche de Bamako, ensuite c'est un peu le Mandé. Et moi je suis descendant de Fakoly Kumba Fakoly Daba. Mon ancêtre a été très très important dans la libération du peuple Mandingue. Donc nous sommes considérés comme des grands hommes au Mandingue.
Radio Rewind. Now we wait it. Radio Rewind. Now we wait it. Radio Rewind. Radio Rewind.
The following content has previously aired on CJSF. But don't worry, we'll be back next week with fresh content. CJSF 90.1 FM. Diverse, independent, yours.